Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems on the island of Maui. They've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now. Become a snack subscriber and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNuiVenison.com. And use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order. You know what my favorite text is? A waypoint in the Onyx Hunt app to a goblin turkey. The list on the Onyx Hunt app features for chasing turkeys is long, but knowing exact public and private boundaries and land ownership details will help you find more places to hunt, whether that's on public or private. I'll be toting the Hunt app through the spring woods in a few states this year, and I recommend you do the same if you want more turkeys on your table. Also, Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onyxmaps.com/hunt this spring.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.
My best turkey hunting stories don't always feature the best calling or the ideal setup or even the desired outcome. They include moments like getting superpowers from electric shock. Okay, maybe that isn't all true, but this is my story, and I believe I'll tell it how I want to.
There must be DNA in humans coded to anticipate the spring. And it feels like some might even have DNA wired for telling turkey stories. The Northern Hemisphere's South Steppin' Waltz is a celebration to many types of folks, but to none more than the hunter of the wild turkey. The most noble spring indicator of the wild things that audibly speak is the gobble of the wild turkey, which by all measurable variables able to be assessed by humans, it's become vividly apparent this gobble is of higher rank than of all nature's declarative trumpets. But then again, maybe the turkey hunters are biased. This is episode one of the Bear Grease Turkey Story series. We've gathered six storytellers from Tennessee, Mississippi, North Carolina, and Georgia. We've got a best-selling novelist, a TikTok celebrity, an undercover wildlife agent, a museum curator, a Mississippi Gas Company man, and a 92-year-old Appalachian mountain hunter. Turkey stories just hit different in March, and I really doubt that you're going to want to miss this one.
I don't know what it is about that bird that really sticks out in my mind. I guess it's more the friendship than the bird. It's a testament to that good medicine that is spending time in the outdoors.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is the Bear Grease Podcast, where we'll explore things forgotten but relevant, search for insight in unlikely places, and where we'll tell the story of Americans who live their lives close to the land. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore. The story of the wild turkey in North America is one of ups and downs, some of it natural, some of it man-induced. The time of your birth often determines your outlook on the bird as a resource, and it's the people that use them that have historically valued them the most. Native Americans use their meat, bones, and feathers in practical ways, but also sacralize the birds. Early Europeans found the place stacked with an estimated 10 million turkeys and used them as a plentiful life-saving food source. But market hunting in the 1800s would almost extirpate them, wiping them from ecological memory, their numbers dwindling down to 30,000 birds continent-wide by the 1930s. But the modern conservation movement has helped restore them to around 7 million birds today. And they've even been introduced into areas in the western U.S. they never inhabited pre-European settlement. Modern turkey numbers in the east peaked in the late 1990s and early 2000s, right when I was growing up. However, in the last 20 years, turkey numbers have declined in many areas in the eastern United States. None more than in my home state of Arkansas. If there's one thing I've learned from my grandfather, Lewin Newcomb, who spent the last 35 years of his life lamenting the loss of the bobwhite quail, it's that it's not wise to put your hope and passion into a ground nesting bird. But for some of us, it's a little too late. We love turkeys. Most of the wildlife stories in our times are positive, but of late, we've been in the valley of what we hope is a cycle. Turkey numbers are on the decline in many areas, but I think it's producing a generation of people that truly value the wild turkey. Scarcity, or even perceived scarcity, is producing appreciation and action for turkey and turkey habitat, maybe more than ever. Let's get to the stories. Our first storyteller is from Leland, Mississippi, and we're sitting in the Mississippi Wildlife Heritage Museum. Billy Johnson is as Mississippi as a cypress knee in muddy water. This story is about a bird he named the Blue Yodeler, but you'll see it's really about a man iconic in Billy's life, a river man.
I'm Billy Johnson, and I'm the director of the Mississippi Wildlife Heritage Museum in Leland, Mississippi. I started hunting on a place in the Mississippi River. It's on the Arkansas side of the river. And there was an old black man that had lived on, born on the island, lived on the island. His name was Clay Matthews. And he had a single shot, 12 gauge shotgun with about a 30 inch barrel. And he believed that when the hen got ready to do business with the gobbler, that she wasn't gonna yelp but four times. And you know, most of the time, people calling or yelp five times. You know, that would be the sequence. But anyway, you know, when I was a little kid, you know, he'd tell me about, you know, when you're deer hunting, you wanna get behind a tree and look around it. But when you're turkey hunting, you gotta get a tree wider than you are and you sit facing the turkey and all. So anyway, as the years went by, I mean, I turkey hunted a good bit, but I got to where I liked to crappie fish a lot better. One year, we got 13 inches of rain in 3 days, and the lake came up 6 or 7 feet and ruined the crappie fishing. It's a lot of little places up in the hills of Mississippi that used to have a store and a post office and maybe at one point a school, and it just got down to where the towns just went away. And usually what happened to start with is wherever it was a spring, where it was water in the hills, you know, it would be little towns would spring up, and then as farming became more capital intensive and less labor intensive, they just, you know, shrunk back down. And one of those places that we hunt up in Holmes County, Mississippi, it's a place where they had planted all the cotton fields and pines, and it was some tall hardwood ridges behind the pines. There was a big gobbler that would gobble on one of those big hardwood ridges, and he'd get real excited and almost like he was yodeling in the middle of the gobbler. And so I nicknamed him the Blue Yodeler, but you couldn't call. If you tried to call to him, he wouldn't come. I hunted the turkey 21 days, and it was like I stepped into a different world from a crappie fishing point of view to turkey hunting. And I would have to try to guess which way the turkey was going to go that morning and not call. And a big storm came up one morning. He gobbled 267 times. And finally, it was just a deluge. I'm talking about when I started walking out of the woods, my boots got full of water and, you know, this and that. And I just didn't know how, you know, when you got a 360-degree area in the woods and you trying to figure out which way that turkey's going to walk that next morning. Finally, I lucked up and he hooked up with another gobbler, and they hadn't gobbled that morning. And so I started calling, and the other gobbler was answering and made a complete circle around me. And I mean, I didn't have that good a place to hide. And as they would gobble from a little bit farther around, I'd have to kind of try to ease around. And I finally saw the gobbler coming and killed it. And it was the big gobbler that I'd been hunting, you know, for 21 days. And for the rest of that day until when I went to sleep, I was just on top of the world. And I woke up the next morning time to go turkey hunting. And about 10 minutes after I woke up, it hit me that I didn't have that turkey to hunt anymore. And it was just like a complete loss of what to do about how to try to kill the turkey. Finally killing the turkey and you're on cloud nine. And the next morning you realize that it's over. And it just complete, you know, I don't know if it's disappointment, but just sad that it's ended. You know, when a deer or a turkey or a big bass that you lose or whatever takes your mind over, completely takes your mind over. And, you know, all of your thoughts are about that, you know, where you're thinking about it when you're awake and dreaming about it when you're asleep. And you know, that's the way I was with that turkey. I think about that old black man, Clay Matthews, a lot. He was the last of those lamp lighters. They had floating lamps, kerosene lamps that marked the channel in the river. He would row out there and fill the lamps up with kerosene and, you know, this and that. And then there's another guy living on another island south there, north of there. They would have those little areas. But I often think about how simple his life was. You know, he had a garden by his house and had tin around the bottom and, you know, fenced in where the deer, you know, couldn't get in there. And he raised hogs and chickens and he hunted. You know, he hunted squirrels and turkeys and, you know, his wife fished. And, I mean, they lived off of what the river and the island afforded them. He would always kill a couple of big gobblers the last week or two of the season, which would be like from the 20th of April to the 1st of May. He knew where some mulberry trees were. And those turkey would come, once the mulberries got ripe, and he knew just to set up in there around those trees. And he knew turkey hunting inside and out. And he was self-taught. One of my prized possessions, when we opened this wildlife museum in Leland, a guy that used to hunt with us on that island came in with a paper bag, and he said, "Here, I've had this long enough." And it was Clay Matthews' turkey call, box call. And whoever made that call had put it together, instead of gluing it together, had used those little cobbler tacks like somebody working in a shoe shop used. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's no telling where he got it or whatever, but after Clay died, you know, he went in his house and found that old turkey call. So he died in the late 70s. So, he lived on that island, you know, his whole life. He was a whiskey maker, a real famous bootlegger up there named Perry Martin. And Clay made whiskey for Perry Martin. And it was just kind of the way of life on the river. I know Clay told me that before they had outboard motors, that the three most important things on the river was flour, tobacco, and whiskey. And then once they had got to using outboard motors and gasoline. So that was the four most important things. But we had a drugstore, and we sold garden seeds and plants and stuff. And My daddy would fly up there in the spring to turkey hunt, and he'd bring clay like cabbage plants and sweet potato plants and enough seeds, you know, for his garden and stuff. So between his chickens and his hogs and what he caught, what he shot, what his wife caught, you know, they ate what they had. They used to have what they called blue logs, and they were like cypress mostly. The river would change and the current would change and those things would shoot up. He would tie them up on the bank. All of the river men that collected those logs for the lumber companies had their own knot. In other words, if the timber buyer came up there, he could look at the knot, hold them together, and know who they belonged to. That was something that Clay did for money. And the other thing, he trapped bobcats. And, you know, when spring came and he had all his hides, he would put them on his back and he would take his boat, go across that White River cutoff, walk across Big Island. And somewhere out in the middle of Big Island was a huge hollow tree. He had cooking utensils and stuff in that tree and a lantern, you know, kerosene. And he'd spend the night there. And then he'd walk to the other side of Big Island and a friend of his would take him across and he'd go to Arkansas City and sell his furs and come back. Clay was a man of nature. In other words, he would go out in the fall and according to how high off the ground the hornet's nests were, he'd predict whether it was going to be a cold winter or warm winter or whatever. The higher they were up in the tree, the colder the winter was going to be. If they were low, it was going to be a warm winter. In those days, I mean, we had a fall turkey season, but before they started having that fall turkey season, all of the guys in my dad's generation were big squirrel hunters. And a lot of them hunted with .22 rifles. And Clay could clean squirrels like you wouldn't believe how fast he could clean them. And wouldn't be a hair on them. But he would rub his hands over those squirrel hides. And according to how thick the hair was, he could predict what the winter was going to be, whether it was going to be cold or not. So, I mean, he learned what he knew from nature itself, you know. And you think in this day and time with all this instantaneous communication and all this stuff, how rich a life he had. People like Clay Matthews were living in a world that was rapidly changing. It didn't change for him, but the rest of the world around it. In this world we live in now with the internet and Instagram and Twitter and emails and text and all that, it makes me wonder, will life ever get to be like it was with him living on those islands?
It's clear that when Billy thinks about turkey hunting, it's filtered through the life of Clay Matthews. The story of the blue yodeler had nothing to do with the man, on the surface that is. It happened long after Clay had passed away. But still, Billy can't talk about him without talking about Clay. What an incredible life he lived. And Billy did a good job of describing how an individual animal at times can overtake you. As frustrating as it can be, the older I get, I realize how unique those times are. It makes me grateful. If you're near Leland, Mississippi, you're going to want to stop by the Mississippi Wildlife Heritage Museum. It's truly an incredible place that will impress you. Tell them that I sent you. I wish every state had one of these, and I wish every state had a Billy Johnson, too. He's done an incredible job. Our next storyteller is named Jack Hall. He's from Tennessee. If there ever was a living turkey hunting legend, it's him. And it's not because he had a TV show, wrote a book, or got a turkey slam. In some ways, it's a shame to even introduce you to him in this way. I asked the man to tell me one of his favorite turkey stories. He really deserves more. Jack is 92 years old. I met him through my friend Russ Arthur, who we'll hear from at the end. Russ says that Jack was one of the original true mountain turkey hunters in East Tennessee. Jack ran Hall Chevrolet in Cleveland, Tennessee. He had the resources to travel and hunt in easier places, but he never did. He loved the mountains. Here's Jack with some history and a funny story.
Yeah, so go ahead and just...
Okay, well, I'm Jack Hall, and I live in Cleveland, Tennessee, and I was born in 31. I'm 92. I started hunting the mountains when I was about 10 years old, when we moved here. My dad was a big hunter, a fisherman, but when he hunted, we didn't have turkeys here when he was young. When I started hunting the mountains, it was squirrel hunting. That's all we did. We didn't have a turkey season back then. We'd run those ridges squirrel hunting. And when I think of that day, I think, why did we do that? but we loved being in the mountains. Then I suppose when I was 25, 30 years old, we started turkey hunting. Oh, for many years, They only had like a 2-day hunt, maybe three times a year, and that's all the turkey hunting you did, you know. And I used to hunt a lot with a friend of mine that worked at Bowater, and his name was Clyde Steiner. And one time I decided I'd get one on him. I was all the time trying to pull one on him. He said his family said he was gullible because I was all the time getting something on him. But anyway, I've walked into this place and he was going to pick me up later, you know. I told him, give me about 2 or 3 hours and come by and pick me up. So I walked a good ways, about 2 miles in. And what I'd done is I had a friend about it, had a bunch of emus. And I asked him if he'd give me a couple of emu eggs, and I bought them from him. And I got a gas mask. And I put those emu eggs in it and packed newspapers around it and everything, threw it over the shoulder. And I built a nest about that big around. And I put these 2 emu eggs in. And before I put the eggs in, I sat in that thing and called turkeys for about an hour, you know, so it looked like the nest was used, you know. And then I put those 2 eggs in, and when I went out, I met him and he said, did you do any good? I said, no, but you would not believe what I found. And he said, what'd you find? He said, I found a nest back there. I don't know what it is. I said, it must have been a dinosaur egg. There's 2 of them in it. And he kept questioning me about that. He said, I want to see them. I said, it's about a mile or two back in there. He said, I don't care. Let's go. I want to see it. So we took off. Walked and walked and walked. It was uphill all the way to it. And when we got there, you'd have to know him to appreciate it because he's funny anyway. He looked at that egg as soon as he walked up. He said, what in the name of God? and I said, I don't know. I've never seen anything like it. And I got down there and had a stick. He said, don't move that thing. He said, I don't believe that's an egg. He said, I believe that's a bomb. I believe those are bombs. I said, no, I don't believe they're bombs. Anyway, I had more fun with him out of doing that. We took him back to town, and he had a workshop. We took him out there, and he kept saying, don't touch those things. And I carried him. He said, I still believe they're a bomb. I said, get me a drill. And he fussed about that, and I drilled it, and he saw it was an egg. And I got to thinking later, I better tell him better that he was older than me. Thought he'd liable to have a heart attack. So I called him and told him. But that's when his family told him. I heard him on the telephone that night. Says, I can't believe you always believe him.
So you fessed up to it.
Yeah, I told him. I was afraid he'd have a heart attack. Well, I could tell a lot of stories about killing turkeys, but I thought I'd tell one about
that.
But he just knew they were bombs, you know. I still would love to to turkey hunt in the mountains, but legs just won't let me do it anymore.
When's the last turkey you killed?
It's been about 3 years ago, and I have no idea how many I've killed, but I'd always kill one or two a year, you know. But that's all you could kill. I've never traveled much and done any turkey hunting, just okoy.
Jack Hall, what an incredible guy, and what a sense of humor. The old emu egg trick. And I hadn't even told you that Jack is an expert ballroom dancer, too. This show is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you'd do if you had an extra hour in your day? A lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. The question is, time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? The best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what's important to you and make it a priority. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. Therapy is important because communication is important, and it's important to talk to people about the things going on in your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greece today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greece. Ready to win Mother's Day and cement your reputation as the best gift giver in the family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. She'll love looking back on these memories and seeing what you're up to today. Even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep updating mom's frame with new photos, so it's the gift that keeps on giving. And this is not a joke. Juju Newcomb has an Aura frame, and we share photos, and they're incredible. Also, my mother-in-law has one. We have them. They truly are really good, really high quality. The Aura frame is easy to set up. It takes just 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app. It also adjusts the display depending on light levels in the room to maintain the true color of your photos. For real, the digital screen is amazing. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame when you use code BEAR, B-E-A-R, BEAR. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code BEAR at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time, Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more. Well, I hate to turn the table too quickly and disorient you, but our next storyteller is about 6.5 decades younger than Jack. Macy Watkins is from Gordon, Georgia. She's an artist, a hunter, and a fly fisherman. I think you'll enjoy her story about gaining superpowers from a hunt. And, yep, Macy is our resident turkey hunting TikToker.
I'm doing it to the mic. My name's Macy Watkins, and my best turkey hunting stories don't always feature the best calling or the ideal setup or even the desired outcome, but yet they are plagued with adversity, bloopers and such. They're always colorful, never dull, and sometimes victorious. They include moments like getting superpowers from electric shock, Okay, maybe that isn't all true, but this is my story, and I believe I'll tell it how I want to. More on that later. So, I had a pretty rough season in Tennessee. Was bound and determined to kill a bird there. Entered a tournament, did some other hunting in Tennessee, and just came up with no luck. Hunted multiple locations, just came up short. It's like it wasn't meant to be. Until the divine appointment of I met Slade, and we got to turkey hunt. And doubled up, and that was our first date. So that was the beginning. Finally got one in Tennessee. So after that, you know, I went back to Georgia. Slade calls and says, let's go back to Tennessee. I have somewhere we can hunt. So I said, all right, I'm spontaneous. So I picked up, went back to Alabama, and we drove back up to Tennessee. Hunted with our friend Tyler Sanders. So it was us three deep in the woods. Slade kills his bird very quickly. So, but my luck, or lack of luck, actually, it wasn't that easy moving forward. The opportunities to kill did not come easy. Hunted another day, had the opportunity to kill some if they would have just taken a few more steps, which I'm sure a lot of turkey hunters have those similar stories. But we were right on a line. Probably had them 10 feet in front of us, and Slade said, hold off, we got to do it by the book, and I'm a person of integrity too. I enjoy doing things the right way. If you're going to do something, it's worth doing right. So we did not shoot those turkeys, probably could have shot a few. Yeah, so we held off. So another day passed, did not get Macy her bird. We said we could hunt the next morning, then we had some heavy rain coming in. So we went out, and we were kind of running and gunning. And we parked the truck, started calling. We immediately heard one fire back. And I was like, oh, snap, that's not that far away. And then we call again, and this turkey was coming in hot and bothered. He was fired up. We were like, dang, that's closer. So the time was ticking. We were on a clock, us versus the bird, who's going to get there first. And it was absolutely my last chance. Yeah, so it was probably mid-morning. We had hunted other spots that morning. We actually saw this patch of cedar trees outside of the wood line. I don't even think we actually had time to make it into the woods because that's how fast everything was happening. Everything that happened from here on out is the funny part. So there was a fence, and you know, the guys are a little taller than me, so they easily got over it. And they wanted to like me to step in their hands and get over the fence. But I was like, no, that's too hard. I'm just jumping. It's not even that high anyways. Well, I backed up. I got a running start, and I ate my words. But soon after that, I also ate dirt, and I tripped over the fence. But like I said, there's clumsiness and adversity plagues all of my turkey hunts. I'm a very clumsy person, and one thing I always say, that it's not a turkey hunt for me until I fall, until I bust it. Doesn't matter how short or long a turkey hunt is, I'm usually gonna fall just because, I don't know, maybe that's my trademark. But the fence caught my rubber light boot. I almost made it. It was just this much that got me. And I hit the ground, and the guys just start laughing at me. I'm like, y'all shut up. We got a bird to go kill. Quit messing around. They were just laughing. I'm like, we were on the clock. Quit laughing. Come on. And we finally got our composure, and we ran over to the patch of cedar trees. I mean, it didn't take long after that. We only had a minute or two once we got set up. Then we just finished the deal. The bird came in, and just if I had one word to describe how that turkey looked, was haggard. He was just rode hard and put up wet. And actually he was wet because it had started raining pretty good at that point. And that's really when I become one with the turkey, because at that point, after 3 days of hunting hard and coming up short, so tired and getting rained on and my hopes were down, became one with the turkey because I was also rode hard and put up wet. So he came in, so where's this hen I was hearing? And just oblivious to us, they're hiding, and I pulled the trigger, got it done. We had some high fives, and when I say I absolutely dirt rolled him, I did. We were on a decline, so made a successful shot. rolled down the hill a little bit, and we were pretty hyped up. It was awesome.
What do you do when you kill a turkey?
So when I kill a turkey, I usually just can't believe it. I'm surprised and excited every time. I mean, mouth opens. I usually laugh out of just pure happiness. There's just such joy in it, especially when there's so much adversity, so many things that might go wrong, coming up short in Tennessee with all my hunts there. It just makes the moment sweeter. Lots of high fives, hugs, picking people up, yelling at the same time, I'd say. So Macy finally got her bird. It's an amazing moment. And then we headed out of the woods, had my bird over my shoulder. But what stood in the way of getting back to the truck was that dang fence. And the guys got over it. And this is a fence that we had permission to hop, by the way. I just want to point that out. So I got to the fence. And I'm like, well, that fence ain't hot. I already touched it when I fell over it. But I made one step over it with my turkey. And I'll be dang if it didn't shock me. And I screamed so loud. And Slade was in the truck laughing so hard. Tyler, who was trying to help me over, was laughing. And you know, like when people laugh at you, but they're laughing a little harder than you're laughing. So I was a little embarrassed. But anyways, I really feel like that day I gained superpowers. Some kind of turkey hunting superpowers from my electric voltage that I got shocked with. And the thing is, that's not a lie, because that was my last bird of the season last year. So time will tell. If you see me out there on a dadgum killing spree, just having a record year this year, you'll know Macy's got something that the rest of us don't have, and that's because I gained superpowers that day. This story ends in a trout stream in North Carolina. So later that week, I went back home. And I love trout fishing. That's my other passion. Turkey hunting and trout fishing are what I was put on earth to do. I tied a bunch of flies that week, and I took a bunch of feathers from my turkey and tied some pheasant tail nymphs, which I affectionately call my turkey tail nymphs. We do a bunch of Euro nymphing in North Georgia in the streams. And if you look at my page, you'll see that I catch the occasional giant trout, because I do have access to a few trophy streams. But my passion is going way up in the mountains, way past cell service, and catching wild rainbows, brook trout, which are native to our area, and brown trout. So I almost got my Cherokee Slam. That's where I was fishing, in Cherokee, North Carolina, not far from my house. I caught every fish that day on flies that I had tied with my Tennessee bird, which just an all-encompassing, full-circle moment. And I feel like turkey hunting makes me a well-rounded outdoorsman, but also a resourceful and more appreciative angler.
Thank you, Miss Macy, for the story. And we'll see if those big talking superpower predictions come true. It's go time and show time in the spring woods right now. I'll be paying attention, and I'll be rooting for you. Be prepared to be disoriented even yet again, as we move across the state line to the great state of North Carolina to our next storyteller. David Joy is as country as cornbread. And if you lined up 10 people and were asked to guess which one was an award-winning novelist who just got off a European book tour, I bet you wouldn't pick him. But you'd be wrong if you didn't. You might have predicted that he was a ridge-running Southern Appalachian turkey hunter by the length of his legs. He's a tall fella and a bona fide turkey hunter. Here's David's story, and it involves a man getting shot.
So I guess one of the things that I like most about turkey hunting is that you have the potential to develop like a partnership with another person that you're hunting with, and in some ways that differs from other pursuits in the outdoors. So, you know, especially like whitetail hunting or something where you're, you know, spending a lot of time in a tree by yourself. With turkey hunting, if you can find the right partner, it serves as a tremendous advantage. And I've been very fortunate to develop relationship with just an incredible sportsman who's probably about 25 years my senior, but just a hell of a turkey hunter. I mean, he's killed hundreds of turkeys. And you know, through the years, I've had the chance to hunt with him a lot, and he and I have kind of developed a relationship where he knows what I'm going to do and I know what he's going to do. And because of that, we have the opportunity to kill a lot of birds that we probably couldn't have killed by ourselves. And so really, that's become one of the things that I look forward to most every turkey season, is just spending time in the woods with him, because I know one day I'm not going to have that. So, you know, jump to last year. This was real early in the season, because I was hunting in South Carolina just over the line, and I was up on a mountain. I was hunting by myself, and I'd been on this bird multiple days, and it had whooped me every day. And it kind of played out the same way this morning. And I sent this buddy of mine a text message, you know, telling him what had happened. And he texted back, "I've been shot." And I immediately thought he was joking. You know, I thought he was just making it up. And, you know, I sent something back, and he said he was at the hospital, and that he was going to be fine, but that he had been shot. And where I was on the mountain, it was kind of an odd spot, because typically you don't have service in the mountains, but I had very good service there. And so my immediate thought was, okay, he's safe, but I knew he was at the far eastern end of North Carolina, and we live in the mountains of North Carolina. So my immediate thought was his wife, and it was like, how is his wife going to get down there to the hospital? But so eventually she reached out and said she was fine, she was headed that way, and that was that. So what wound up happening was that another hunter shot this buddy of mine thinking that he was a turkey. And he had just enough time to kind of roll on his side so that he took the majority of the shot into his ribs and his shoulder. He was shot with Longbeard copper-plated number fives. And somehow or another, you know, just by the grace of God, none of it got him in the head. And thank God they were shooting, you know, copper-plated lead instead of tungsten, because I think it would have been a different story. I think he'd be dead. So he immediately, you know, is at the hospital. They're working to get the shot out of him. They put him on antibiotics. He comes home pretty much that next day. But within a week, there was a secondary infection that started that luckily another doctor caught. And, you know, they wind up working on him and get him healed. But, you know, that doctor told him that if he hadn't taken care of that secondary infection, it would have killed him. It would have traveled to his brain and it would have killed him. So all of this is going on, and turkey hunting is kind of out the window, you know, and I'm devastated for him, but I'm thankful that he's alive. And so my turkey season last year was real funny, you know, but I decided I was going to hunt with an old Winchester Model 12, because that's what he always hunted with. So I hunted all season with an old nickel steel 1928 Winchester Model 12 20 gauge. So time goes on, and through the month of April, and I'm, you know, men are not wont to share their feelings, so it was always hard to try and, you know, feel him out on where he was mentally. And so I spent a lot of time talking to his wife, and she kept saying he needs to get back in the woods. And I thought she was right, but at the same time, that's not one of them things you can pressure somebody to do. You know, I mean, he had just been shot, and thank God, you know, didn't die, but you know, that's an incredibly traumatic experience that was obviously going to linger pretty heavy. And so it was this delicate balancing act of not wanting to push him, but also knowing that where he needed to be was in the turkey woods. And so we started having those conversations, and I just kept telling him, you know, that if it made him more comfortable, I wouldn't carry a gun. You know, we'll just go in the woods together. And you know, he didn't really want to do that. And you know, I'd almost given up on asking him. And out of the blue, he sends me this message one evening, and he said, "I've got a bird pinned down." And I said, "Well, let's go chase him." He said, "Well, meet me at the house the next morning." And so I did. And we rode out through the mountains. It was the first day we hunted, you know, together last season. we head out this ridge, you know, to try and hear if this bird is roosted where he thinks it'll be. And we get out there, and sure enough, that bird starts hammering across the valley before daylight. And, you know, I know that it's on. I know, you know, Raymond's got him pinned down, and I know for a fact he's going to know the landscape and know the moves we need to make to get on him. So it's super, super steep, and we just drop off the side of this mountain through a bunch of laurels and rodeo and get down into the bottom along this field, and the birds are roosted at the bottom of that field. And we kind of make a plan on what we're going to do. And right about the time that I was going to go sit at my tree, I could just sense that he was really nervous. It was something I'd never experienced with him before because he knows how safe I am with guns. He's been around with me with guns all the time. You know, I always tell him when the gun's loaded, I tell him when it's unloaded. And he just started asking a lot of questions about the gun. And so I told him, I said, Raymond, I said, I'm going to unload my gun. I said, I'm not going to touch it. I said, I'm going to get behind you. And I said, I'm not going to touch it. I just wanted him to hunt. So we start calling to this bird, and they pitch out into that field. And they had a bunch of hens with them. And for the most part, we spent the morning, you know, calling to no avail, trying to call a bird that had everything he wanted. And so, you know, we spent the morning calling at him. And every once in a while, he'd answer, but never made a move up there towards us, just stayed in the bottom of that field. And about mid-morning, probably around 10, those hens started to leave the field to go to nest. When they did that, Tom started following them. And I had already made a move further away from Raymond. My plan was to try and pull those birds up to us. And that field made a real hard, like a hard right dog leg back up above us. And so my plan was to try and make it sound like there had been birds that moved up that field that they couldn't see. And so I was up there and I was calling, and they were still answering me, and it was late season, so I'd started gobbling on a box call. And every time I'd gobble on that box call, they'd answer me. But so those birds are working up the field, and as turkeys, you know, always do, they did not cooperate. They went the opposite direction. And they went up the left-hand side, and that gobbler just kept on, you know, gobbling with his hens up through the woods. And I thought, well, this is over. And about that time, I seen a turkey pop up over the hill in that field, and he was on the right-hand side. And he was coming in silent. I think he was probably a subordinate bird, you know, that had broken off from them others, but was coming to check out all that noise he'd been listening to all morning. And so he pops up, and he starts walking through that field. I mean, just gorgeous. The sun's just hitting him perfect. And I'm watching him work up through that field, and I think any minute he's going to get in front of Raymond, and, you know, and Raymond's going to smoke him. And it gets to the point where I'm convinced that he's passed him. And all I'm thinking is, you've let that bird get past you because you want me to kill it. Because that's something he would do. That's just him. He's always thinking of others before he's thinking of himself. So I'm thinking, you idiot, man, you've let this bird get by you, and now we've got to hope it gets all the way up here to me. And right about the time that thought is settling in my mind, I don't hear Raymond, but I know he must have called, because that bird threw his head up and he just walloped him out there in that field. And I don't know what it is about that bird that really sticks out in my mind. I guess it's more the friendship than the bird. And I think it's just a testament to, you know, what the outdoors and what the sporting life means to people who can't live without it. You know, it's a testament to that good medicine that is spending time in the outdoors.
That was a good story, David, and a serious one. I think you should write a novel about a man getting shot by a stranger in the back while turkey hunting, and the shooter escapes on a crooked-hoofed mule. Years later, the shot turkey hunter unknowingly saves the life of the mule trapped in a swirling Mississippi River eddy. The steed presumably belonged to the mysterious shooter. We don't know who he is. And the beast has a unique brand on his left haunch, BP3. But unfortunately, The mule dies 3 days later. And, I mean, it's a long story, and David would do such a better job telling it, but it's kind of a plot twist and weird, but the shooter was actually the man's brother, and they didn't know about each other because of the father's double life. And their father, a turkey hunter, had accidentally told them both about the same ridge to turkey hunt on where they fatefully met on the morning of the shooting. Oh my at the drama. And the mysterious brand stood for Black Panther 3, because three generations of those hillbillies believed they'd seen a black mountain lion. Like I said, David would tell it better. Anyway, in all seriousness, the thought of getting shot turkey hunting is a nightmare. And if you don't know much about turkey hunting, it's a unique hunt because we roam around in the woods making the calls of a turkey without any hunter orange on, because turkeys can see color. Most firearms hunting requires people to wear hunter's orange to be visible. Hunting accidents are rare, but possible. But honestly, to me, the other version of the nightmare is being the one who made the mistake and shot someone. I think about that more than getting shot. Be careful out there, folks. You know, whenever I look at pictures of my kids from the past year or even just a few months ago, I'm so amazed at how fast they're growing up. And then it hits me hard. I'm getting older too. That's why planning for my family's financial security has become a top priority. Making sure we're prepared and having enough life insurance in case something unexpected happens and I'm out of the picture is crucial. And Fabric by Gerber Life makes it simple to get the protection that's right for your family. Fabric by Gerber Life was designed by parents and for parents to help you get a high quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. There's no risk to apply. They have a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/bear. That's M-E-E-T, fabric.com/bear, meetfabric.com/bear. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Ready to win Mother's Day and cement your reputation as the best gift giver in the family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. She'll love looking back on these memories and seeing what you're up to today. Even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep updating mom's frame with new photos, so it's the gift that keeps on giving. And this is not a joke. Juju Newcomb has an Aura frame, and we share photos, and they're incredible. Also, my mother-in-law has one. We have them. They truly are really good, really high quality. The Aura frame is easy to set up. It takes just 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app. It also adjusts the display depending on light levels in the room to maintain the true color of your photos. For real, the digital screen is amazing. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame when you use code BEAR, B-E-A-R, BEAR. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code BEAR at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time. Seafoam motor treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more. We're now going to go back to Leland, Mississippi, to the Wildlife Heritage Museum to meet our next storyteller, who is from the Delta. His name is Roy Stubbs, and he worked for the gas company. Roy's in his 80s, and it's clear that he has a unique appreciation for the wild turkey. I was so glad to be able to capture his story and a little bit about his history.
My name's Roy Stubbs. I live in the Mississippi Delta, and that was the place to be if you had the opportunity to hunt turkeys, especially along the Mississippi River. My desire for turkey hunting started at an early age when a friend of ours in a little town I lived in, Benoit, Mississippi, would kill a turkey and bring it back when we'd have our little Wednesday morning at school. And he would bring his turkey in and lay it down and talk about the turkey. And then he'd take a leaf off of a tree of some kind and use that as his call. And so it kind of stayed with me. And so I fast forward then several years, and I had the opportunity to become a member of a hunting club along the Mississippi River. And there was lots of turkeys. And what time frame we're talking about is the late 1960s. So being around those turkeys for the first time in the woods, I just had this desire building, but hunting turkeys is just so much different than hunting anything else. You just have to have a lot of knowledge. So I had a friend of mine that was a barber in a small town near me, and I used to go and sit in his chair and talk with him. He made his own mouth calls, and he taught me a lot about calling turkeys. He taught me how to make a mouth call even. And I hammered out, got a piece of aluminum and some rubber, and I made my first turkey I killed in 1967. I called it up with my mouth call. Later on, I developed a way to use my natural voice, and I used it most all the time until I got too old to. Turkey hunters have a bond all across the country it's just a part of hunters and camaraderie, the love we all have for each other and for the sport itself. The turkey is a magnificent bird, and it's not to be taken lightly that when you make a kill, to thank the Lord for letting you have this opportunity in his creation. So in 1984, I lived in Greenville, Mississippi, which is right on Mississippi River. My club I hunted on was just a few minutes north of town. And so started the season off and had a turkey that just caught my attention right away. The mainline levee, if you've never been there, runs from Memphis to Vicksburg. There's dikes on it. We call dikes that are run, and they're there to control the water flow as it flows on toward the Gulf. And so we travel on these dikes. They have a road on top of them, and you can drive down through your woods, and a lot of them go all the way to the bank of the Mississippi. So we ride down them and stop and call, and turkey answer, we get a hunt on. So this particular year started off with this turkey, and I noticed the first few times I'd drive down there, he would gobble. So I said, okay, I know where you are. I know how to get you. Well, that started my season-long turkey hunt. So I would go out and call that turkey, and he would gobble. And so we would get in, I'd move, he'd move. And literally, I would go every day and hunt that turkey. With my job that I had at that time, I'd get all my men working, and I'd sneak off, get in my truck, and drive up there and call him, and he'd answer me, and I'd go hunting. So we did this day in and day out, as the weather permitted, and Sundays off mostly. Well, we came down, it was going to be the last day of turkey season. Well, unfortunately, on the last day of turkey season, my wife had us a social event to go to. Well, I thought I had a train, but she slept it slipped through on me. And so I'm thinking about my turkey. I got one last chance to get him. And so I had many encounters through the year. I'm crawling up on snakes. I had deer walk up to me, check and see what I'm doing. I mean, coons, possums, armadillos, because I did a lot of belly crawling through that year trying to crawl up on this turkey. He was smart, and he was really fun to hunt. And it was just calling experience and learning experience that I'll never forget. So the last days, and so I get there about the middle of the afternoon, and I start my hunt, and I got a plan. I know what he's done the last few times I hunted him, so I've come in a different direction, changed everything up, got a different call, but I was going to have to do my crawling. So I eased up and kept going, and he kept coming a little bit. Finally, I had him in range. I guess one of my disadvantages was I was laying down, and it's hard to shoot a gun holding it up besides a turkey head. And anyway, I got it all set, got it all ready, got my gun up, and just looking at that turkey, just the magnificence of him. And I really sometimes think the good Lord has a hand in who we are and what we do. And he also has control over what happens in the woods so many times with us. And I'd rather blame the Lord, I think, sometimes than blame myself for not being able to make the kill or whatever. So very carefully, I got my gun up and got my head down on it. I thought just right, which is difficult to do laying down. And you can't move. So I get everything just right. I pull the trigger, and the turkey had expression on his face. So he just lifted up and flew right over the top of me about 5 feet over my head. And he said goodbye for the day, for the season. And I got up and I said, tipped my hat to him, and I said, thank you for a great season. And I think that turkey today, he's in turkey heaven, I know.
What a classic gentleman, overflowing with appreciation for just getting to chase one. And who knew there was a turkey heaven? These boys from Mississippi are just made different. And I'm extending a genuine Bear Grease hat tip to Mr. Roy Stubbs. Our final storyteller is Russ Arthur from Cleveland, Tennessee. If Russ's name sounds familiar, it's because he was on our Genuine Outlaw series of Bear Grease, episodes 52 through 56, a couple years ago. Russ was the undercover agent who hunted with Louisdale Edwards in western Arkansas in the 1990s. Louisdale said Russ was the best turkey caller he'd ever heard. Russ is one of those guys who has a story much bigger than a single turkey story. And it was an honor to sit with him and hear this one about his late father, Jim Arthur.
Well, my name is Russ Arthur. I was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee, in a community called Hickson, Tennessee, right outside of Chattanooga. I was blessed to have a father who was a passionate outdoorsman. My dad killed his first turkey in 1961. Of course, I was only 2 years old at that time, so I don't remember that. But he would always hunt on this management area where there was only the season back then in the 60s, there was only 1 or 2 days a week that you could hunt. There were very limited counties in the state of Tennessee that had turkeys. He would always come home and talk about his adventures. The hunts were normally Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and he would always go up on a Thursday and camp. He had an old station wagon, a 50-something model station wagon, and he would go up and camp out of it, and he would normally hunt on Friday and Saturday and come home Saturday evening for church on Sunday. As a kid growing up, 7, 8, 9-year-old kid, I could not wait to hear the stories. And it was later in life that I figured out that my dad had done a very noble thing, and that is he took the curiosity of a kid and turned it into a passion, because he would give me just enough information about what he was doing, where it was at, and I had this mystical place in my mind that I wasn't old enough to go to yet. And he didn't drag me along as a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old. He waited till I got old enough that I could handle a single barrel, and he started taking me. So I had this passion through my dad, and one of my favorite turkey hunting stories will have to go back to, and this is, if I get emotional, I'm sorry. Whew. Well, he had an old call, and he called it Sweet Thing. And it was, and I've got that call with me today. He bought it for, I think it was $3 from a gentleman by the name of Earl Disharm. As a 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old kid, I had heard all these names, the Earl Disharm, the Bobby Card, the Jack Halls, the Charlie Elliotts, the Gene Denton, the Dan Laymans, the Glenn Honeycutts. These were all people's names that were these true turkey hunters. And I was kind of like a little kid that was hearing about a gunfighter. You know, these were legends. You know, when I first started getting to come and stay at camp, I would meet all these guys. And we had a place in the mountains that he had taken me to the year before, and we had heard a few turkeys. And I was 13 this particular year, and I was carrying a single barrel 20 gauge. And he said, "Son, I'm gonna take you on this ridge." And there was an old trail. He called it the Indian Trail. And it was just a hunter trail. Nothing that's marked on a map. And he took me up there when I was 13. And he set me in a gap, and he said, "You stay here. I'm going to go on out the Indian Trail. And after about 2 hours, if you hadn't heard anything, come on out the trail. I will either be on the trail, or I'll put a rock in the middle of the trail and draw you an arrow with a rock telling you which direction I went, and you wait right there." Well, that was our way of communicating. So I'll admit, I'm 13. I'm sitting there. I cannot wait for it to get daylight. And I thought it would never get daylight, and I never heard anything. Now I'm going to have to back up again. The only call that he bought me, what was called a Lynch Jet turkey call. I still got it today. It, in my opinion, it was a terrible call. It was a very small slate call, inset in wood, and had a burnt wooden peg. And it was good for a cluck or a purr, but that was about it. So an hour after daylight, I couldn't stand it. I needed to go find Daddy. I was ready for some action. So I ease out the trail, and I get, probably 300 or 400 yards from where I had left, and I hear a turkey just hammering. And I mean, it's just hammering its head off. And I think, I can call that turkey up. You know, I've sat with my dad, and I've watched this last year. I can do this. And I sat down on that call, and it was terrible. And that turkey just, it gobbled. And I just kept doing it, and it gobbled every time. And then it started going away. Next thing I know, I heard something coming up through there. It was my dad. And he was frustrated. I'd run that turkey off of him. He had it, he was getting ready to shake hands with it. He came right straight from where that turkey was gobbling. And all he said was, he said, "We need to work on your calling." You know, and I've got to tell this story. If you think that there's not a higher being, 10 years ago tomorrow, my dad passed on February 10th, 2014. Well, we were getting ready to bury him, and he had left in his workshop. He was very meticulous. There was a wooden box full of notepads. They were all the same make and model. And I reached in, I said, "I've never seen this before." And I did not know that my dad had kept a diary. And the day we were burying my dad, I found this in his workshop. And it was as if he had set that out for us to find. I reached in and I pulled out and I said, "What is this?" And I opened it up and it was a journal. And when I opened that up, it turned till April 12th, 1972, and I got to read about what he thought about that morning when he left me in that gap. I closed it up, I put it back, and I'm not red anymore since. So one of these days, I'm going to take that and go to the mountains and go to the cabin and read it. But it was pretty amazing that the very day that he left me for the first time in the mountains, that I pulled one of the 72 books out and turned to that date. So,
what did he say?
He was just talking about how proud he was, and I didn't, be honest with you, I didn't read it all. But when I recognized where it was at and what he was writing about, it would just overwhelm me. And I closed it up, went on. But anyway, Dad was a great man.
What an incredible story and man. Jim Arthur was the first chapter president of the Chattanooga National Wild Turkey Federation chapter. And in 2003, he was inducted into the Tennessee Turkey Hunters Hall of Fame. Russ said there was a time when the state was trapping turkeys out of areas where Jim hunted, and many people were mad about it. But around the campfire, Jim would advocate to his peers that this was a short-term sacrifice for a long-term gain. He was influential as a grassroots spokesman for the wild turkey relocation, which ended up being the salvation of the wild turkey. I truly love these Turkey Stories episodes. And like Mr. Roy Stubbs said, turkey hunters share a unique bond around a unique bird. I can't thank you enough for listening to Bear Grease. We've got another Turkey Stories episode coming up. We put our heart and soul into these episodes, documenting the stories of our collective history. Be sure to check out Brent and I's Mississippi River Expedition film on the Meat Eater YouTube channel. And if you're out west, check out the Meat Eater live tour schedule. I'm going to be there at every show. Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems on the island of Maui. They've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now, become a snack subscriber, and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com, that's MauiNuiVenison.com, and use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.